Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Smarty Pants, the podcast of the American Scholar magazine. I'm your host, Stephanie Bastek. Stephen Greenhouse was the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times for 19 years. He's retired now, but he hasn't stopped writing about labor, not by a long shot. His last book, The Big Squeeze, written 10 years ago, is a detailed report on how American workers are being abused by their bosses. Corporations are freezing wages, replacing long-term employees with contractors and subcontractors and freelancers to whom they have no responsibilities. And where full-time employees are to be found, bosses are replacing pensions with 401ks, trimming down paid holidays, vacations, and sick days, pressuring workers to do more per hour, forcing complaints out of the court and into arbitration, including non-compete clauses, not to mention offshoring jobs to countries with fewer labor or environmental protections and cheaper wages. In the 10 years since then, corporations haven't exactly changed their tune, but the labor movement has. There's been a surge in organizing, from the service industry to Silicon Valley, and we can see it in places like the Fight for 15, the Red for Ed teacher strikes, walkouts at Google and Wayfair. The list goes on. Right now, for instance, there's a huge campaign at airports nationwide led by airline catering workers making poverty wages. 11,000 of them across 28 cities voted to authorize a strike. Where did this momentum come from? Where's it going? In his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, Stephen Greenhouse tries to answer that question. Why did worker power decline so much over the past 50 years? And what can we do to rekindle that collective power? He joins us in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
It's great to be here.
I think it's instructive to compare the United States to countries like Germany, France, and the UK, because labor organizing kicked off around the same time, but with drastically different results today. At a unionized McDonald's in Denmark, for instance, you can make $20 an hour, but in the U.S., you're stuck with minimum wage and zero union protections. Not to mention that in the U.S., labor wasn't able to win paid parental leave or sick or vacation leave that even approaches the standards of Europe. Why not? Why were France and Germany and other European countries able to seize those when U.S. labor power wasn't?
That's a great question. So we talk about American exceptionalism. And in my book, I really hammer this concept that the United States suffers from anti-worker exceptionalism because in many ways, workers here have fewer rights than elsewhere. And when we talk about American exceptionalism more broadly, we talk sometimes about America being the good guy and the cop of the world defending democracy. We also talk about American exceptionalism, that why was socialism weaker in the United States than in European nations? And I think, you know, one of the ramifications of socialism, the left being so weak in American history, is that corporations have far more sway over the government and workers have far less sway over the government. That's why, you know, the United States is the only industrialized nation that doesn't have paid maternity leave or paid parental leave. The only other nations in the world that don't have paid maternity leave are Papua New Guinea, Suriname, and a few Pacific Island states. The United States is the only industrial nation that doesn't have paid sick days, that doesn't guarantee workers vacation, whether paid or unpaid. And in the European Union's 28 nations, every worker is guaranteed at least 4 weeks vacation. And other aspects of this anti-worker exceptionalism is of the 36 industrialized nations in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, we have the lowest minimum wage as a percentage of the median wage, and we have the second highest ratio of low-wage workers. The only country that tops us of the 36 is Latvia. So, I mean, all this shows that, you know, workers in the United States, you know, maybe our wages are pretty good compared to other countries, but we don't have a lot of basic rights, and low-wage workers are really getting squeezed. Corporate profits as a percentage of overall national income is at its highest level since World War II, and worker compensation, wages and benefits, is at its lowest level since World War II. So something is broken, I submit.
Right. Well, and wages are lower than they were in 1973, accounting for inflation. It's like pretty nutty. But I mean, as you pointed out earlier, part of the problem, too, is that fewer people are enrolling in unions. Why is that? And do you feel like part of it has to do with our historical amnesia about labor wins and what unions have done?
So, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I think, you know, to my mind, far too many people I meet, far too many Americans, especially younger Americans, just know very, very little about labor unions and what they achieved. I'm not saying labor unions are great. I write about the corruption, the discrimination against women, the horrible discrimination against African Americans, against Chinese immigrants, against Latinos. But, you know, unions have done a lot, arguably more than any other institution, to lift workers. And there's that wonderful bumper sticker, unions, the folks that brought you the weekend. And I think a lot of people don't understand that these nice things they have, the 40-hour work week, employer-sponsored health care, overtime, weekends, they were the product of long struggle. I think a nice chapter in my book about a strike in 1909 called the Uprising of the 20,000. By 20,000, actually 30,000, 40,000 female garment workers in New York. And at the time, it was the largest strike by women in American history. And these women complained that they used to have to work from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., that they wouldn't see the sun. They'd have to pay for the needle and thread. Sometimes they'd have to pay for drinking water. Sometimes they have to rent the chairs they sat on in the factory. And if you thought, you know, the current era is the only time that you know, male bosses sexually harassed women. No, it's happening back in 1909, too. But one of the big demands of the strike was a 52-hour work week. And I think, you know, so many Americans think, you know, the 40-hour work week was handed down to them by God, but it really was the source of struggle. And I think, you know, there have been all these studies showing that Americans are working more and more hours than they used to 20, 30 years ago. And I think there's been backsliding. And I submit that one reason is that unions have grown weaker. And in the book, I really try to show, you know, how unions grew and how worker power grew and how that really helped improve the lot of millions of workers, with an emphasis on how individual workers use their agency to really get things going, to bring other workers along with them. And out of the initial agency and heroism by some of these workers, it really got the ball rolling, and hundreds and thousands of workers joined them, and it, you know, turned from individual agency to mass solidarity, and that's how movements grow. You know, 2-3 years ago, I'd be talking with people, and they'd say, "Oh, labor is dead. It's dead in the water. There's not much hope for it." And then West Virginia just, like, you know, exploded. Almost not quite spontaneous generation. It's kind of when you treat people bad enough, especially self-respecting, fairly secure people like teachers, they're gonna, you know, get up off their knees and really fight. And I think in many ways the teachers were the vanguard in the effort against years and years of austerity and tax cutting and giving tax breaks to corporations. They said that might be great for the corporations, that might be great for the rich, it might be great for Republicans to get reelected, but it ain't good for teachers, it ain't good for students. And we, the teachers, not only going to fight for ourselves to improve our salaries, but things have gotten really bad for the students.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you say, like, something is in the air, because Red for Ed is not the only movement.
Adjunct professors, graduate students.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and you also have, you know, glimmers in gig workers unionizing at the Freelancers Union, and then the fight for 15. So, I mean, what is the something in the air? Is it just that we've, like, hit the nadir of corporate treatment of workers, or is there something else at work?
Good question. So, I was talking to some friends in New England. So there was this big strike in New England a few months ago, the Stop and Shop supermarkets.
Yeah. Yeah.
So oftentimes when there are strikes, especially at a place like supermarkets, consumers, you know, say, oh, this stinks. This really gets in my way. This is going to make it harder for me to shop. But, you know, some people I spoke of, they said there was huge community solidarity backing the union. So I think people are really feeling that, you know, to borrow Donald Trump's phrase, that the system is rigged and that corporations, you know, they have record profits, stock markets at a record level, plus they just got this humongous tax cut, even though they already had record profits. And I think a lot of people feel that workers are getting the shaft. Public opinion polls show that unions have the highest approval rating in 15 years, 62% according to the Gallup poll. And there's been a big study by folks at MIT saying that 46% of non-union workers say they would join a union tomorrow if they could. And that's up from around 32% in the 1990s. So I think people feel this, you know, workers feel the system isn't working as well for them and they are more favorable to unions. But as I said, only 6.4% of private sector workers are in unions. So there's some disconnect there. To my mind, the major reason the unionization rate has fallen so much, not just globalization wiping out manufacturing jobs, but that American corporations have become so adept and aggressive at beating back at fighting and killing unions. And I have this line in the book that's become, you know, that folks everywhere are like quoting that, you know, in no other nation do corporations fight so hard to beat back unions as in the United States. And that's true. And, you know, in Europe, in Japan, in Australia, in New Zealand, in South Korea, Canada, companies kind of work hand, maybe they don't love unions, but they work hand in hand in unions. They realize that unions are an accepted, important entity that represents the interests of workers. But I think a lot of American companies just see unions as a horrible enemy, and that we got to annihilate them, extirpate them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how do white-collar workers fit into this? Because you talked a little bit about, you know, we have a lot of stories about how cushy jobs are at places like Facebook or Google, for instance. And yet now you have, white-collar Wayfair employees banding together to protest the fact that Wayfair was contracting with ICE, or, you know, Google employees saying that they don't want the company to cooperate with U.S. government or Chinese government efforts to create, you know, surveillance technology. So how do these different categories of work almost intersect in the labor movement?
So with white collar workers, in my view, there are like several different strands, several different things going on. One is what we saw with Me Too and sexual harassment. A lot of white collar women were treated horribly. They were scared to speak up. You know, one of the big issues I focus on in the book is the lack of so-called worker voice, the ability of workers to speak up and to be listened to. And I think one of the reasons there's been such a Me Too explosion after the initial Harvey Weinstein revelations is that there's, you know, there's been so much harassment in so many workplaces, and so many women have been scared to speak up, or even when they spoke up, management didn't listen to them. And people finally felt, white collar workers finally felt emboldened to do something. So that's one strand of what's happening. Another strand is generally labor movements, you know, worker power is used only to improve pay and to improve their working conditions and to get vacations and maybe more parental leave. But now we're seeing these, you know, we don't like that Amazon or Google are helping ICE. We don't like that, you know, you have this contract to help in this war. And there have been these serious protests that we really haven't seen before in that way in American history. And that's, I mean, that reflects somewhat that these workers feel secure enough about their jobs that they're willing to protest something that doesn't directly affect their paycheck and their treatment at work, but their sense of worth and what the company they're proud in is doing. And they want to be fairly pure and ethical, and they don't like it when their companies are doing something they view as unethical. And like, to my mind, it's admirable that they're willing to stand up.
Well, what about collaborations between these different levels? Because, you know, it used to be that a company sort of did one thing. You know, it was like a mining company and you had management and then you had workers. But at a place like Google or Facebook, you have, you know, you have the people who build the software, sure, but you also have, you know, cleaning crews, you have bus drivers, you have all kinds of workers at various levels of pay who are working for the same company or contracted by people who work for the same company. So have you seen any collaboration in that way, or how do you feel like that's happening?
Again, very good question. So a little. So I was going to include this in my book, but I have so much in about California in my book, I decided, you know, I write about the Los Angeles teacher strike and how it's an unusual model of union community cooperation, how the union wasn't focused so much on increasing its own pay, but getting, you know, more school nurses and more librarians and more social workers and more green space and smaller class sizes. And I write about this wonderful labor management partnership, Kaiser Permanente, that where workers and union and management work closely together to improve service, to improve care, to cut costs, and to increase pay. And Silicon Valley, there's been, you know, one of the most successful unionization efforts in the country among the cafeteria workers at Facebook and Google, mm-hmm. and the shuttle bus drivers who drive from San Francisco to Silicon Valley. And there's been some support by the white collar workers, probably not as much as we might have liked, but there's been some support. And but you know, the unions that did that organizing drive really have their act together. And you know, again, when you're dealing with some of the most profitable, most value, high value companies in the world, it's not hard to make them look bad. Like, why are you paying $7.25 or $8.25 or $9.25 an hour when you're worth, you know, gazillions of dollars?
Right. Why does this Amazon fulfillment center not have air conditioning? Why are they not being paid minimum wage? How much do you earn, Jeff Bezos?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I learned, and I'm going to, trumpet the cause of the media for a second. So as unions have grown weaker, mm-hmm. it's harder for workers to speak up. It's harder for workers to protest. And I think as a result, it's, you know, newspapers and TV and radio that has shined a light somewhat on some of the real scandals. For instance, you mentioned Amazon, you know, in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania. You know, the workers there are like worker bees. They run around insanely, you know, picking goods off the shelves. And it was sometimes literally over 100 degrees inside. And so many people fainted and got dehydrated that Amazon literally had ambulances waiting outside because so many people were dropping each day. So the ambulance would take them to the hospital or would work to rehydrate them. And it was only when a terrific reporter in the Lehigh Valley did a story shedding light on that Amazon said, hey, you know, maybe we should install air conditioners there. And you know, the media really plays an important watchdog role on workplace matters, and let's hope it continues to do so. Crazily, you know, when I was at I was the labor and workplace reporter at the New York Times for 19 years, and there was a year or two when I was the only standing remaining full-time labor and workplace reporter at a daily newspaper. The Washington Post no longer had the LA Times, no longer had the Chicago Tribune, no longer had the Boston Globe, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. So, you know, I don't know if that, you know, it made me feel like I was becoming an extinct species or maybe even a brontosaurus. But fortunately, since the Great Recession, since that really shined a light on how badly some workers were squeezed, more and more places are covering labor issues.
Well, and a lot of those newsrooms are unionizing as well. So,
yes.
You know, you might think that they could be related.
You know, so you asked about white-collar workers. So, you know, one of the exciting corners in labor right now is a lot of white-collar workers are unionizing. Mm-hmm. In digital media, in the most anti-union newspaper in the country, famously anti-union, the LA Times has unionized. The Chicago Tribune, considered the second most anti-union paper in the country, they unionized. The, you know, Slate and Vox and Vice and the New Yorker is unionized, and New York Magazine is unionized, and the New Republic. So there's that's been going on. Adjunct professors, you know, 2,800 adjunct professors at Miami-Dade College have just unionized. You know, tons of graduate students are unionizing. So a lot of white-collar workers are unionizing. So people ask, why is this going on? What's going on?
Right. Unionization drives might be on the rise, but retaliation against that is still quite easy. You know, outlets like Gothamist unionized and then were promptly shut down by their owners. And that's been true of, you know, small shops or small businesses whose workers have unionized or tried to organize and then been fired. So given those threats and given the measly percentage of people who are unionized today, how do you think workers can regain their power? How do you think that we can win back that voice that has been stomped on for decades now?
You've won. You've asked the $64 trillion question. That's the very tough question that I really wrestle with. And in the book, I try to say, you know, there should be an effort to rebuild union power, but it's extremely hard to make unions grow because there's such massive employer opposition. I talk about how over 50% of the times when workers seek to unionize, management threatens to close the operation. And management often says, you know, you might even end up with lower wages and worse benefits if you unionize. So, you know, and management has 24/7 access to workers. You know, they show anti-union videos in the lunchroom, in the break room. They require workers to attend these, you know, sophisticated lectures by high-paid anti-union consultants. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has ruled that companies have every right to bar union organizers from even setting foot into the parking lot. You know, there was a Supreme Court case where union organizers were putting flyers on the windshields of cars, and the union said, you have to give union organizers some access. And the Supreme Court said, no, property rights trump worker rights. So things are really out of balance right now. So the essence of your question, how do you rebuild worker power when unions are so weak? So, you know, an accelerated route to giving workers more power and more voice is like letting workers elect members to the corporate board of directors. And in Germany, workers elect just under 50% of the directors on corporate supervisory boards. And I think that's one reason, you know, Germany treats its workers much better. They invest much more in training. They haven't offshored, outsourced nearly as much as American corporations. Elizabeth Warren has proposed letting workers elect 40% of board members. Tammy Baldwin has said 33%. In my book, I make what I hope is a strong case for public financing of elections. The Karl Roves of the world, the Grover Norquist of the world, you know, talk about big labor, that labor is some big, bad, you know, humongous force in politics. Well, you know, there are statistics showing that in the 2015-2016 election cycle, corporations donated $3.2 trillion to candidates, whereas unions gave only $213 million, less than 1/16 as much. And in lobbying in Washington, corporations spend just under $3 billion a year, while unions spend less than 1/60, just $48 million a year. So there's a huge disproportion of power in what's happening in Washington. So you wonder, why should, you know, the Koch brothers or the Walton family or Sheldon Adelson have 8 gazillion times as much voice in our politics as a public school teacher or a carpenter or a hair salon worker? We have to stand up and fight to help workers who are really, really having a hard time nowadays.
Labor history is long and instructive, and not even Stephen Greenhouse was able to fit it all into his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up. There's a little bit from every sector in there. GM employees, Uber drivers, school workers, farm workers, hotel housekeepers, and service workers of every kind. Not to mention the historical wins and losses that informed the present. We'll be back next week. Till then, take care and stay sharp.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.